heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 132, covering the week of July 30th through August 3rd, 2018. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute, to like our Facebook page at Abbeville Institute, and subscribe to our YouTube page at Abbeville Institute. You can find all those social media buttons on our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. You can also give us an email address while you're there, and we'll give you a free ebook, Kirkpatrick Sayles, Emancipation Hell. And don't forget that we exist on your generous contributions alone. If you'd like to help the Abbeville Institute, you can go to abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you'll see a button that says Support. Click on that, and you'll see our donation levels. We have a variety of levels. You can donate monthly or annually. So just go check that out. We have a new donor interface that makes it much easier to donate to the Abbeville Institute. We also have a conference coming up in November, the first week of November. Details are forthcoming on our website, so check that out. It'll be in Texas. And the topic at this point is going to be nullification and secession. So it's going to be a great time. We're going to have some really good speakers, and so you're going to want to be there. Information will probably be up within the next week. Okay, all of that said, let's talk about the week that was at the Abbeville Institute. And I think one of the topic for the week was misinformation. This is something that people talk about a lot. You know, we're in the era of fake news. You have the president out saying that the problem with the media is that it presents fake information. You have a climate, and people believe there's a climate that presents, in terms of historical study, disinformation, or they present information without showing the other side accurately. Particularly, this is true in their mind of establishment historians who may present the information, but their interpretation then is skewed. And I think this is the main point to make. It's not that the information is not there. You can read, for example, James McPherson, his Battle Cry of Freedom. There's a lot of good information in the book. It's the interpretation of the events that are questionable. It's the choices that McPherson makes, or Foner, or others make in their books, and the way they describe things that are often questionable. The language that's used. These are the real problems with mainstream histories. And just like news, it's the selection of topics and the presentation of those topics that often leads to the disinformation. And the South has suffered the most for this. And part of that is, as I've said, I think in the podcast last week, the episode last week, that as Kerry Roberts said at our summer school, we're living in New England, America. New England has won so thoroughly, and as he pointed out, that in 1988, you had two New Englanders running for president. And New England, even though, I mean, you look at, he mentioned 2004, we had John Kerry and George W. Bush, George W. Bush being born in Connecticut and Kerry a transplant, but still both in some ways from New England. I mean, Bush was from a New England family. The Bushes are related to the Adamses, but Kerry being a transplant. But you still have a New England America, and part of the problem with that is that New Englanders are so miserable, they think if they move to South Carolina, they think if they move to Alabama, if they move to the Gulf Coast, if they move to the Gulf Coast of Florida, if they move somewhere outside of New England, it's going to miraculously make their life better. But they still are New Englanders, so wherever they go, they bring their misery with them. They bring that worldview with them. That is the major problem with it. You see, New Englanders cannot escape being New Englanders. Just like someone who's really from the South and embodies the South can't escape being a Southerner. Ronnie Van Zant said that. You can take a boy out of old Dixieland, but you'll never take old Dixie from a boy. And that's the truth. You can't, this is cultural. You cannot take the culture from the people no matter where they go. They're going to be what they are. And we don't really think about that. We think in, as America, as some proposition nation, some ideological creation, that culture doesn't matter. And it matters 150%. And even the way you view the world through history or news is going to affect that. I just saw yesterday on social media, one of the Kennedy brothers posted, and I don't know where the article came from. They'll probably email me after listening to this about it. But it showed Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer as Southern plantation owners. I mean, it's preposterous. These people are both from outside the South. And to say that they are Southern plantation owners, and the point is that these people have become, the Democrat Party is still the old Democrat Party. I'm going to talk about that in this particular episode because Paul Yarbrough has a piece on that. But they're Schumer's from New York and Pelosi's from California. Infected, I'm from San Francisco, California, infected with Yankeeism. And that's what the left coast has become in California. So you cannot get away from this idea of culture, and that's really what makes the South the South. It's the culture of the people. It's not the geography. Certainly that lent to the economy that the South would pursue. Without question, you have a situation where because of the climate and geography in the South, you're going to have a particular type of economy, and same thing in the North. But the culture was there before that. The culture in New England was there when the first Puritans set foot in New England in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. That became the dominant culture. And the culture in the South was there when the first Englishmen set foot in Virginia with the Cavalier mentality. And then, of course, you had the influx of Celts in the South, you had the influx of Quakers in the North, and then you had the Hudson River Valley, which was a different culture in and of itself. These cultures matter, and we can't get away from that when we start talking about American politics and American society. And not only that, Southern history. When somebody comes to the South that does not understand the culture of the South, it becomes a specimen to be studied, something that you have to put under a microscope and say, look at these curious people in the South. I don't understand them. Let's look at them like a bug. Let's study the Southerner as a bug, as a specimen. When in reality, the Southerner, if you look at the culture of the West, not California, the West Coast, not the coast itself, but you look at the culture of the West, the Mountain West, you look at the culture of Appalachia, you look at the culture of the South, the Deep South, Virginia, the Tidewater, it doesn't matter where you are. You find that particular view is dominant. The South, the Jeffersonian American, dominated much of American history. It's only recently that has gone away and has been replaced by the Puritan American. The idea of the collective, the liberty of the community over individual liberty, something the South, in terms of its long-standing position on liberty, never would have supported. So culture matters. You can't get around it. And I think that's the important takeaway to get from any time you study history. You have to look at the culture of the people and the background of the people writing it. I remember when I was an undergraduate, this was discussed quite often, even as a graduate student. But I don't think that people really think about this much anymore. If somebody comes into writing history as an Eric Foner, as a communist ideologue, that's how they're going to write history. And that's their worldview. Even Eugene Genovese was a New Yorker. And so he always had that perspective in mind. He wrote great Southern history. I think he, more than anyone else, was able to check that at the door, so to speak, and then try to write about the history of the people from the people's perspective that he's writing about. That is the mark of a good historian, someone that can get the essence of a people without looking at it from their own worldview. And unfortunately, American history is not written that way anymore. It's written by ideologues. It's written by people that come in with preconceived notions of what it is, and then they write about it. And you find that quite a bit with mainstream historians. It's not the history itself they get out of it, though they do make mistakes. It's not that. It can't be that. What it is their own interpretation, their own worldview that influences how they're going to write the history or how they're going to write the news. This is all it is. And understanding that is the key to understanding and unlocking the problems that we have in America today. We still have cultural problems. We still have incompatible things in America. You can take any issue, and it's going to be that way. It's all about power. It always has been about power. And you have a certain subset of America, North and South, I mean, this is not something that's exclusive to Northerners, who want to dominate the Union and want to dominate the other sections and have a one-size-fits-all idea. This is not the part of Southern history that we support or American history that we support. We support the idea, the Abbeville Institute, of this Jeffersonian America, a real federation of states, the idea of real federalism, that culture matters. And New England can have their culture as long as they keep it in New England. And the South can have its culture and celebrate it as long as they keep it in the South. And no one should change that. No one in the South runs around and says, you know what you guys in New England should do? You guys in England should do, New England should do, of course, you know, adopting their language. Y'all should say y'all. Not say you guys. Y'all should say y'all. You should do that. No one runs around in the South anymore and says, you know, that Thomas Nast version of Santa Claus, that's not really Southern. But that was a Northern cultural imposition on the South. They had their own views of Christmas and St. Nick. But this Northern view of Santa Claus becomes dominant. And so that's a cultural imperialism. That's just one example. There's all kinds. And I'm going to talk about today, in this particular episode, a couple of things that have to deal with that. So, the first is one of the great myths, and this is all about myth. One of the great myths of the 1860s is that Lincoln wanted to avoid war. That he wanted to avoid war, that he was very concerned about avoiding war, and he was just dragged into this thing, kicking and screaming. He didn't really want it. Well, the piece that we ran on Monday is entitled Colonel Baldwin Meets Mr. Lincoln. It's written by John M. Taylor. It's an essay from his book, Union at All Costs, From Confederation to Consolidation. It's self-published. It's a very good book. I've been promising him for, gosh, over a year to write a review of this, and I've just had no time. But we got a chance to publish. He asked if we would publish a chapter from this book, and so we did, and it's excellent. And he told me a little side story about this, that he actually got into a debate with Guelzo, who's just a notorious neoconservative Lincolnite. And he brought this particular issue up, and Guelzo's response is, you're looking at the wrong sources. Well, what sources are those? Could they be Baldwin himself? There actually was an entire pamphlet written on this particular episode when Colonel Baldwin met Mr. Lincoln. And it is, it was published in 1866. It's essentially testimony about this particular episode, and it's not some lost cause myth. And what you get out of this particular issue is that when Baldwin meets Lincoln in April of 1861, April 4th, by the way, 1861, essentially this is a private meeting, and Baldwin was a Unionist. And what he was trying to do, and what supposedly happened is Lincoln said, if you do X, Y, and Z, you know, I'm not going to do anything about this. But not just that. Lincoln had said in this particular interview, it was a private interview at the White House, which at that time was the executive mansion. It wasn't the White House, so Teddy Roosevelt. That the entire conflict was about tariffs. As Mr. Taylor says, quote, during the conversation between Baldwin and Lincoln, it became obvious to Baldwin that the issue of slavery was not Lincoln's primary concern. Digesting Lincoln's comments, Baldwin began to see the issue as, quote, the attempted overthrow of the Constitution and liberty by the usurpation of a power to crush states. The question of free soil had no such importance in the eyes of the people of the border states, nor even of the seceded states to become, at one, the cause of war. Now, Baldwin had made some suggestions to Lincoln that he simply didn't follow through on. Baldwin actually said, this is from Taylor, Baldwin, quote, Baldwin told Lincoln that Virginia would assist and stand by him, even to the point of threatening him like her native son, George Washington. Embellishing his point, Baldwin added, so sure am I of this, of the inevitable ruin which would be precipitated by the opposite policy, that I would this day freely consent, if you would let me write those decisive lines, you might cut off my head, were my own life my own, the hour after you signed them. And he's talking about, of course, coercion. And Baldwin had said, look, Virginia will support you as long as you just follow the Constitution. He also suggests that Lincoln call a convention of the states to deal with the situation. So Lincoln was looking for a tariff. Taylor continues, quote, Lincoln did not like what he heard. He painted the South as insincere, as people with hollow words backed by no action, and claimed the resolutions, speeches, and declarations from the Southerners are, quote, a game of brag meant to intimidate the federal administration. And then he says this, quote, Baldwin probed for the primary sticking point, leading Lincoln to ask, quote, well, what about the revenue? What would I do about the collection of duties? In response, Baldwin asked how much import revenue would be lost per year. Lincoln responded, 50 or 60 millions. Baldwin answered by saying a total of $250 million in lost revenue, based on the assumed four-year presidential term, would be trivial compared to the cost of war, and Virginia's plan was all that was necessary to solve the issue. Lincoln also briefly mentioned concern about the troops at Fort Sumter being properly fed. Baldwin responded that the people of Charleston were feeding them and would continue to do so as long as a resolution was in sight. Though Lincoln appeared to be genuinely touched by Baldwin's plea for peace, he was alarmed at the prospect of lost revenue. He did not like the idea of the southern states remaining out of the Union until a compromise could be reached. His reply underscored this deep concern, quote, and open Charleston, etc., as ports of entry with their 10% tariff, what then would become of my tariff? Though it was Fort Sumter and Charleston Harbor where things came to a head, lower duties would have been applied and attracted trade to all southern ports, meaning Richmond, Savannah, Wilmington, New Orleans, Mobile, Galveston, etc. Lincoln's reply to Baldwin made it clear slavery was not the central issue. He did not mention slavery, but voiced alarm at the amount of revenue that would be lost if he allowed the Confederate States to exist as a separate country. Import duties comprised the vast majority of government revenue at the time. So there you go. And Lincoln already said in this particular interview that he was too late. Lincoln awkwardly paced about in obvious dismay and exclaimed, I ought to have known this sooner. You are too late, sir, too late. Why did you not come here 4 days ago and tell me all this? Another fact not revealed in the conversation by Lincoln was that he had already authorized reinforcement of Fort Sumter and Pickens on March 29th, and the ships were preparing to sail. Baldwin replied, Why, Mr. President, you did not ask our advice. Besides, as soon as we received permission to tender it, I came by the first train, as fast as steam could bring me. Yes, but you are too late, I tell you, too late, Lincoln replied. Perhaps this was the point when it sunk in as to how serious the southern states viewed the situation. Lincoln was already pursuing war, even during this meeting. And here's Baldwin saying, we can save the Union. And Lincoln says, nope, can't do it. Can't do it. I got to have my revenue. So this is where you get to myth-making. And of course, some people would say, well, that's just lost cause nonsense because the sources are questionable. It's a testimony that was given by Southerners. It's Robert Louis Dabney writing The Origin and Real Cause of the War. Which is a memoir of a narrative received of Colonel John B. Baldwin. Of course, Dabney can't be trusted because he's just a Confederate. But Taylor gets into how you can trust it because of some of the individuals who were aware of this particular testimony and what they said. So, when you look at, for example, the portrayal of the Copperheads, this is an excellent book review by Scott Trask, The Saints Are Marching On and On and On. It was written in 2007, published again here, and it's a review of the book Copperheads, The Rise and Fall of Lincoln's Opponents in the North by Jennifer Weber. Now, I recommend people read this book because, again, there is good information in it. The interpretation is bad, and she gets some things wrong. For example, one of the things that struck me when I read the book years ago, she fails to mention that John Breckinridge carried Delaware. I mean, this is she gets it entirely wrong in the book. So she makes some sloppy mistakes. But again, it's interpretation, as Trask gets into with this. It's the most recent comprehensive study of the Peace Party, or as she calls them, Lincoln's opponents. And her entire position in this particular book is that everything was based on race. The only reason these quote-unquote copperheads were against the Lincoln administration because they hated black people, which is simply not true. Were these people racists? Well, yeah, they were. But so were probably 95% of all Americans, white Americans, in the 1860s, North and South. Now, Trask says this, a study of Northern peace Democrats is long overdue. Unfortunately, what we have here is a nationalistic melodrama masquerading as a work of scholarship. 140 years after the shooting stopped, historians still cannot resist keying their narration to the music of Julia Ward Howe. And that's exactly what you get in this. She calls the Copperheads reactionary reprobates. They deserved what they got. They deserve to be bayoneted at night. The way she describes people, blinkered by ideology, deluded by utopian fantasies. They didn't have Lincoln's understanding of the times. They were deaf to his arguments. So she has no sympathy for her subject. She is blinded by her own view of the war. She herself is ideologically driven, even though she claims the Copperheads were that. She says this, quote, the Copperheads were so ideologically driven that they were blind to the threat the war posed to the nation. And as Trask says, actually, that was their greatest concern. What she meant to write was that they were blind to the threat the secession posed to the nation, but that's not right either. For over 20 years, the Northern Democrats had warned their countrymen that political abolitionism would lead to the catastrophe of secession and civil war. And they were right. Republicans, on the other hand, dismissed these warnings and routinely derided the Democrats as Union savers, even after the election of 1860. Of course, Weber is unaware of such vital facts, but that does not keep James McPherson from anointing her in his preface of the book as the nation's, quote, foremost historian of the Copperheads. How can McPherson withhold his encomium after reading that General McClellan was, quote, nothing close to Lincoln's equal in either moral fortitude or political prowess, or that when Grant took command in the East, a new day had dawned over the Army of the Potomac. Again, so this is all Weber's historical bias. It comes out in her culture. She gets some things right. I mean, she brings out, there's some fantastic information in this book, and in my course on the war, I recommend people read it. But it's her interpretation that's wrong. It's her interpretation that suffers. So it's when you get to this idea of fake news, it comes down to interpretation. That is the problem. When you look at, for example, in the piece on Wednesday, Lost Cause Myth or Yankee Propaganda, when you look at this particular issue, it's about the attack at Lawrence, Kansas. And this is written by Lewis Lieberman. And you have two different interpretations of this particular event. It comes down to interpretation. What actually happened? Was the attack some kind of lost cause myth, or was it more Yankee propaganda? And what I like about this particular piece, Mr. Lieberman shows both sides. But he brings up an interesting point. To say this thing was just, these people were innocent men being killed, a lot of these people were deserters from the Union Army. It may have been the Red Legs participating in and marauding into Missouri and killing people there. They were also all armed. As one historian pointed out, anyone over 15 in Lawrence had a firearm and they were trained how to use it. So this was not some type of attack on poor boys or women and children alone. This was an attack on men they considered to be soldiers. And they certainly overwhelmed Lawrence, but it was an attack on soldiers. This is what the South considered it to be. And of course, other historians disagree. But there's, it's okay, you see, for Sherman and Grant to go and wage total war on the South, but it's not okay for Southerners to go in and essentially do the same thing in the North. It's not okay. You can't do that, you see. And Southern sources, again, are just lost cause mythology. They're biased, you see. They're biased. You can't rely on those sources. They're biased. But this is the problem. Someone would look at this and say, that's all bias. Those are just Southern sources. They're just lost cause. This is lost cause. They're all lying. It's lost cause propaganda. They're liars. Essentially, that's what's happening here. They're saying they're liars by writing what they saw. So it all comes down to viewpoints and presentation. And again, culture, worldview. And when you get to the piece on Thursday, July 4th comes and goes, but doesn't square with The Swamp by Paul Yarborough. He gets into this, how we have an infection, a disease, that really is the way we view the world. And it's all about myths of history. It's the Lincolnian myth. People like Victor Davis Hanson and Dinesh D'Souza, that the Republican Party has always been the good guys and the Democrats have always been the bad guys. This is one of these stupid myths that's running around out there that is problematic. I mean, you watch Legend and Lies on Fox News, and this is what you get. It's problematic. It's not nuanced. And the gatekeepers of acceptable thought want to make sure this is what we get. And he brings out the fact that, you know, this was not true. We didn't ever have a nation. I mean, all things we've talked about in this podcast before. And, of course, the South is just a specimen. That's always been the problem. It's always the Southern problem. The Southern problem in America. If it wasn't for the Southern problem, America would be a grand utopia. Not for the Southern problem. That's a New England version of America. And he talks about that, how these people in D.C. will never understand July 4th. They'll never understand what it was because they can't, because their culture will not allow them to do it. North and South. Or I should say, not North and South. These nationalists will not allow them to do it. And a nice example of that ultimately and finally is the view of Leadbelly. This is kind of it's a piece that doesn't seem to fit, but it does. And this is written by Michael Martin, and it was born out of our conference on Southern music. He didn't present on Leadbelly, but Leadbelly, Hugh D. Leadbetter, who was from a plantation near Mooringsport, Louisiana, his family owned their own land. He was born in 1881, and he came from black property owners. And he was a good musician. His family encouraged him. Of course, he liked to brawl, and that led to time in jail. And he was sentenced to a hard labor to chain gang in Texas, but he was let out. He escaped, and then he went back to prison. And then the Texas governor, that story is Pat Neff, visited the prison and saw Leadbelly and said, "You know what? I'm going to commute your sentence. You're so good that you need to leave. In fact, the Philadelphia Independent, which is one of the country's leading black newspapers, had a headline in 1925, "Two-time Dixie Murderer Sings Way to Freedom." And this is a quote from that particular newspaper. Asked what inspired him to sing to attract the attention of Governor Pat Neff, Leadbelly said he thought of the biblical Paul and Silas in prison. He reviewed how long they both sang and prayed at the midnight hour, and how the earth trembled and the walls of the prison shook. The locks on the cell doors fell and they walked out free. Leadbelly visioned the biblical miracle, and it seemed as if the very locks on the prison cell were dropping. But they weren't. Then he sang a song he had composed himself. He waited until Governor Neff made his regular visit to the prison, and then serenaded the Texas chief executive with the lines, "If I had you, Honorable Governor Neff, where you got me, I'd wake up in the morning and set you free." So here you have a Texas governor setting free a man who supposedly he hates, if you listen to the northern narrative of the South. I mean, white Southerners hated black Southerners. There's no way that was ever going to happen. Leadbelly, though, wanted to be a country music singer. You see, that's something else this gets into. Leadbelly wanted to be a country music singer, but people in the North would not allow it. He was only allowed to sing blues music. He was only allowed to sing what they called race music. That was it. You could only sing what they said you can sing. And so it wasn't the racism of his manager. It was the racism of the North that locked Leadbelly into a particular type of music. That was the issue. And a friend of mine brought up Ray Charles and said the exact same thing happened to Ray Charles. He wanted to sing country music. He wasn't allowed. He could only sing race music. As Michael Martin says, the politically correct mainstream narrative of Leadbelly's life is that he was a pardoned murderer who fled racism in the South, was exploited by his Southern manager John Lomax, and was finally able to express himself as a folk artist in the North. The truth is that Leadbelly's music was appreciated in the South, which is probably why he was released from prison then there twice for violent crimes. He appreciated all the music of his Southern homeland, but attitudes at the time portrayed him as a relic of the past. While he achieved some mixed results in the North, eventually partnering up with the likes of Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger, his musical variety was not as well received, and he died before becoming a major commercial success. He also tried to partner up with John Lomax in his later years and received intermittent assistance from John's son, Alan. But many histories will portray Lomax as an outright racist that humiliated and used Leadbelly for profit. But this is simply not true. So, again, it's myth and narrative and culture, and all these things matter when you're talking about history and the portrayal of events and perspective. It all matters. And if we don't think about that, if we don't keep that in mind, if we don't lose sight of that, it's easier to wade through fake news and fake history. Until next time, good day.